Welcome to 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I'm Daniel Emery Price, joined by Chad Bird. Chad, how's it going, man?
Here I am. I'm good. A little under the weather yesterday, but I am back and ready to roll today. I had a little injection of Hebrew this morning. I think that cured me of all my ailments.
There you go. It's a magical language.
Yeah, it is.
It's got healing properties.
It has healing properties. Takes care of all my ailments right there.
Is Hebrew the language we're all speaking in heaven,
Chad? Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. That's right. I mean, that's the advantage of learning Hebrew here is that you won't have to take the remedial course when you get to heaven.
You want to take the intensive?
Yeah, right. Those first 3 weeks are tough, but at least learn the alphabet while you're here. Aleph, Beit, Gimel, Dalet, and so on. You'd be a step ahead.
There you go. This podcast has become very practical for the everlasting.
Yeah, the podcast that prepares you to speak in heaven.
That's right. Right on. Well, where did we leave off last week?
We didn't get very far last week. We covered seven verses in chapter 17 of Exodus. So we made a little progress, just not much. I thought we were going to cover the whole chapter, but I think we got distracted on something. We have a reputation for that.
We do.
But it's always good. It's always good. Now we get to do battle today. So we're going to pick up with Exodus 17, verse 8, take us through the rest of the chapter, and talk about Amalek and the battle that Joshua engaged in with them. And then we'll jump into chapter 18, which is all about some different stuff, Jethro and setting judges over Israel and things of that nature. So anyway, verses 8 through 16 is what we're going to pick up. And this is the first time since leaving Egypt that Israel has encountered a human enemy besides the Egyptians that met them at the shore of the Red Sea. That, you know, they've had lots of issues. After they left Egypt, they had, of course, issues of hunger. They didn't have enough food, so God gave them manna and quail. They had issues of thirst, and so God gave them water, or one time they had issues of a bad water, so God sweetened the waters at Marah. So they've gone through various kinds of struggles already on their journey, even though they haven't been gone that long. Really encountered any kind of physical threat outside of the Egyptians at the Red Sea, but that's going to change now. And this is kind of, I guess, completing the circle, if you will, of all the stuff that Israel is going to face, not just now, but in the ensuing years as they work their way through the wilderness. They're going to have problems of kind of internal strife of various forms. We'll see some of that later on. And they're going to have ongoing problems about not having enough water and not having enough food, but they're also going to have some situations where they encounter enemies. So this is the case of a group of people called the Amalekites. And they attack Israel. Now, one little detail which I find interesting that's not recorded here, but that is recorded much later in Deuteronomy 25, I believe it is. Yeah. Deuteronomy 25, 17 through 19 talks about this as well, but it adds a detail that we'll get to in just a minute. These two in tandem. So here's what happens. So Amalek, it says, came and fought against Israel at Rephidim. So what are they going to do? Well, Moses comes up with a plan. It's kind of a twofold plan. First of all, he says to Joshua. Now this is the first time that we've met Joshua. We're going to see him, of course, a lot through the rest of the wilderness narratives, but this is the first time that we're introduced to Joshua. So, you know, it just assumed that you know who he is. That's why he's not mentioned earlier in the book of Exodus. So Moses says to Joshua, "For us and go out and fight against Amalek. And tomorrow I will station myself on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand." So Joshua does exactly what Moses tells him to, and he fights against Amalek. But here's the second part of the strategy. So Moses takes with him his brother Aaron and another guy named Hur, H-U-R, and they go on top of this hill. And kind of a strange thing happens. So Moses has the staff of God in his hand. And when he holds his hands up, then Israel prevails. They're winning the battle. But when he drops his hand down, then their enemy, the Amalekites, begin to prevail. Now, I don't know if you've ever held your hands, like, just try to hold your hands up in the air for a long time. But it's, you know, it's pretty tough. You can do it for a couple minutes, and then your arms get to hurting, and especially Moses is holding his staff in his hand. He's an old guy. You know, he's in his 80s by now. So this isn't going to last very long. So his hands are heavy, and so they come up with a practical solution. It's a picture, really. I get this stone, and Moses sits down on the stone. I guess his legs retired too. And then Aaron gets on one side of him, and Hur gets on the other side of him, and they hold up his hands. And they do this all day long. It says his hands were steady until the sun set. And the net result of this is that Joshua was able to overwhelm Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Now let's stop. There's another couple of verses. We'll stop there. Stop there for a second. Now I want to throw in, first of all, the detail that gives us a little bit better picture from Deuteronomy, a little better picture of what was going on here. So this wasn't just that, you know, the Amalekites saw the Israelites coming. And they were about to go into their territory, and they didn't like it. And so they, you know, they meet them head on, and they have this ongoing battle that takes place. No, it was kind of a guerrilla attack, because Deuteronomy tells us that the Amalekites came up behind them and attacked the stragglers at the rear when they were faint and weary, it says. This is Deuteronomy 25, verse 18. So you kind of have the picture of the Amalekites. I mean, they're taking full advantage of the fact that the Israelites are exhausted from their journey. They go around behind them. They're not attacking the strong warriors. They're attacking the people who are bringing up the rear, the people who are worn out or exhausted. Kind of gives a fuller picture of exactly what kind of people that we're dealing with when we hear about the Amalekites. Israel, of course, was there to take their land. They were simply passing through. But for some reason, the Amalekites decided that they would take advantage of the situation and attack the Israelites from the rear. So that's kind of the picture of the battle that takes place. Now, I think the aspect of this story is the means by which the Israelites achieved victory. I mean, this wasn't necessarily due to Joshua's great military leadership, that the Israelites were, you know, kind of a special forces. They were, you know, these top-notch warriors able to take on the Amalekites and beat them. The story, when you read it, makes it sound as if everything depended not upon any kind of military might, but it depended solely upon one guy holding a staff up in the air.
Yeah. I mean, you have to assume that, like, I mean, Israel, there are a bunch of slaves that got set. It's not like they're not like a regular people group that has like a military or something.
Like they probably were like carrying on military training exercises in Egypt, right?
No, you don't really train your slaves to fight. That's not like nobody does that. That's a bad idea. Nobody has like the soldier section of slaves where they're like, yeah, we're going to teach these guys how to do formations and how to strategize in war. No, that would be a really bad move to teach them that. And I mean, you have to even wonder, you know. I don't know what great weapons these guys that Israel has. I mean, the whole thing. I mean, they're not a nation in the standard sense here. Like they have not fought wars or battles or anything like that. They're used to making bricks. And
this is a large group of escaped slaves.
Yeah.
This is unfamiliar territory to them. I mean, obviously they've been suffering along the way. They don't have enough water. They don't have enough food. Most of the people who live in this part of the world this, that's their home. I mean, they know how to find food. They know where the water is. They've grown accustomed to living in this harsh desert environment. But Israel, I mean, they're traveling. And I mean, they are on the way. And so when you're traveling that much, when you aren't able to get enough food, enough water, yeah, I mean, it weakens you physically, it weakens you emotionally, and certainly you're not ready to do any kind of great battle against another nation.
Yeah, and you have to wonder, all of those things taken into account, if that's not why the Amalekites are like, it's just, we could easily take these guys out.
You know? Like shooting fish in a barrel.
It's got to be part of the motivation. Just like, look at these guys; they got no army. They don't look like they're not ready to. Like, just, let's just like go in there, take their stuff. It's gonna be easy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we do know that's been part of the culture of this part of the world for generations. If you read even the beginnings of Islam with Muhammad, I mean, they were doing this kind of stuff. They were making raids on other people. And this was just something that the folks did. And so the Amalekites, I mean, they're raiding this people group as they're passing through their land. They chose the wrong nation to do this to. This is God's special people. This is his chosen nation. And so they messed with the wrong people.
Messed with the wrong God, anyway.
Yeah, they messed with the wrong God. Yeah. So here we have, Moses goes up on top of this hill. And he takes the staff of God in his hand. I love that phrase. We saw it first back, I believe, in chapter 4. After Moses leaves the burning bush, it says he takes the staff of God in his hand. I think that phrase occurs maybe 3 or 4 times in the Torah.
Interesting thing about,
but I mean,
I might steal your thunder. I don't know. That's what I was going to say. The staff. Whenever I hear staff of God, I always think of Psalm 23. When you have your rod and your staff, they comfort mm-hmm. me. If you ask what is, it's weird. Sometimes people will be like, oh, your rod and your staff, you cover me. That's because, you know, that's how you, like, God, you know, he disciplines those he loves. And so he'll use that to chastise you a little bit. That's actually not what they use that for. that was like the shepherd's crook thing. Like they had like the thing that was shaped like that and the sheep's neck fit in that. And they could gently like pull them back on the set. But like, if you see David, what he would do with that rod and that staff is like you hear him like beating back lions, beating back bears. Like, I mean, this is a weapon, not to beat sheep with, but to beat predators with. This is a defense. This is to defend the sheep. And so, I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm spreading the butter thin. But when I hear like kind of like rod of God or staff of God, that's what I think of is like this. Instrument, this tool that God that represents God's defense of his flock.
Yeah, and that's exactly what he's doing here. It is the staff of Moses, but it's called the staff of God. They're one and the same, right? Moses' staff is the staff of God. Moses' shepherd crook is the shepherd crook of God. So this becomes the means by which he defends his sheep against these wolves. The Amalekites are the wolves attacking his flock, and so God uses that to rescue them. So, I mean, I think it's interesting to ask, and we don't know the answer to it, but at least to ask it and to ponder what the answer might be as to why it mattered if Moses' hands were up or not. I mean, verse 11 says that when Moses held his hands up, Israel prevailed. And when Moses held his, when it, you know, when he got tired, his hands started drooping, then Amalek prevailed. And so, I mean, the ancient Jewish interpretation was basically that this was like the emblem of prayer, and that when Moses' hands were up, he was praying to God, but when they came down, he was exhausted, not praying, and so Israel began to lose the battle. And there's magical explanations that some people try and give. The one The one I think rings true, at least for me, is that this staff, I mean, this was a potent image for the Israelites. They first saw this staff in the hand of Moses at the Nile River when he struck the Nile and turned it into blood. But they've seen it in lots of other situations throughout the 10 plagues. It's a staff that Moses used to strike the rock that we saw earlier where the water came out. It's the staff that he uses to the Red Sea into so that Israel could pass through. So this staff, probably for the Israelites, kind of was an icon, if you will. I mean, this was like a symbol of God's power for them because of all the things that God had done through it. And so when it's lifted up and they see that, they're on top of the hill. When they see that, this is the means of encouragement for them as they're fighting the battle. The pledge of God's fidelity to them to give them victory as they're facing their enemies. Anyway, that's my spin on it. You have any other ideas?
Well, I always, again, now I'm not saying this is gospel, but whenever I read this text, to me, like, the whole thing seems very crucified. And
you're about to go early church on us.
Yeah, it seems very crucified, and so, you know, if you're talking about like Moses with his arms outstretched, which with the instrument of God's defense in his hands. It sounds very much like that, like the, at least the image that you get in your head of Christ being crucified in defense of his people. You know, at the very least, the imagery is there, where with his arms outstretched. I mean, it's very very much like Samson, when Samson goes and stretches his arms out. Between the pillars, and then like destroys all of God's enemies, which we know is ultimately done with the outstretched arms of Christ on the cross, destroying all of our enemies, sin, death, and the devil. And so, I do think that, you know, that the Old Testament just how God is like that, and he likes to hint. They're like, why must you have your arm stretched out? Can you like just hold it with both hands and just hold it over your head? Why do you got to be stretched out, man? Like, or is God just painting a picture and saying, like, ultimately where victory against your enemies will ultimately be won will look like this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we know that God does that. I mean, he's dropping hints throughout the Old Testament as to what, as to the crucifixion.
And of course, unlike Moses, Jesus will not have his brothers there to lift his arms up.
Hand.
No, God will have those hands nailed. They're not going anywhere. He will be left alone to do that. He will not be able to cry out for Peter and John to come and bear him up. They'll all abandon him, and so he'll do that ultimate work all by himself.
Yeah. You know, there was a second century, call him a church father or not, but an apologist is often called Justin Martyr, who is one of the earliest treatments that we have, longest treatments we have of someone talking about the practice of the church and the arguments of the church for Jesus being the Messiah. And there's a long, it's called the Dialogue with Trypho. Trypho was a Jew. Justin was debating back and forth. And like I said, this is one of the earliest, longest treatments we have of any kind of Christian apologetics. And Justin Martyr, he's usually called, he actually uses exactly what you were talking about, that example of the arms of Moses as a prefiguring of the cross. It became a part of the early church iconography, their way of picturing exactly how the Old Testament was portraying what Christ would do for us already here in the book of Exodus. So, hey,
I mean, good company.
You got like second century legitimacy there.
That's right. That's right. And of course, I mean, Moses is a representation of the law. While being a Christ figure, he also represents, I mean, we see this in the Mount of Transfiguration where you have Christ there as the gospel, you have Moses there as the law, and you have Elijah there as the prophets. And so you have the law, the prophets, and mm-hmm. and then in the gospel there. So of course the law would have to have someone come and lift its arms up, of course. Mm.
Yeah, the law can't do it on its own. That's for sure.
Cannot.
So, yeah, I mean, in the second half of Exodus 17 with, that picture on one side and a picture of the crucifixion on the other, you put those two together and that's what you have. You have a prefiguring of how God is going to give us ultimate victory, not in one whose hands had to be supported by two friends, but instead one who were held up by the nails on the cross. Yep. Good stuff.
Good stuff, man.
So Joshua prevailed, and they wanted it to be recorded. That's how the chapter ends. The Lord says to Moses, write this in a book as a memorial and recite it to Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. So Moses builds an altar. He names it Yahweh Nissi, which means the Lord is my banner. And he said, the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war against Amalek from generation to generation. So Amalek really screwed up here. I mean, like we said earlier, they picked on the wrong people. They picked on the wrong God. And God held true to his word. I mean, it took a long time. During the reign of Saul, the first Israelite king, Saul went out and he did battle against the Amalekites. And he almost destroyed them. There's a whole interesting story about that, which we don't have time to get into. But Saul, he destroyed the people, but he spared the king along with the best of the livestock. Of him disobeying what God had clearly told him through Samuel, then the kingship was taken away from Saul as a result of that. And it was only much later during the reign of one of the good kings, a guy named Hezekiah, that Amalek was finally utterly destroyed. So, I mean, we're talking centuries later when this promise finally came to its fulfillment, but it did. The Lord might not always work fast, but he works faithfully. So he eventually was true to what he promised here. And it all goes back to this earlier episode. That was the reason for this ongoing conflict between Israel and Amalek. Israel, like an elephant, they got a long memory. They don't forget these things.
That's why they wrote them down, so, man.
Yeah, they wrote them down. taught it to Joshua, and even built an altar at the site. So that's the last half of chapter 17. I guess we're ready to jump into 18 now.
Let's do it.
We got there. We're almost to everything that happens at Mount Sinai. That'll begin in chapter 19. But we got one more episode that we need to get through before we actually get to what happens at Mount Sinai. And this actually is it's a good counterpoint to what we just saw with the Amalekites, because what's going to happen here is we have another non-Israelite representing not the Amalekites, but the Midianites coming to Israel. And so what happens, what we just talked about, the very opposite of that is going to happen here when a guy named Jethro, whom we've met before, comes to visit Israel. So chapter 18 is all one unit. It's not like a series of one story with two main sections in it. And it's all about the visit of Jethro, who is the father-in-law of Moses, and Moses recounting to him everything that's happened to them and a sacrificial meal that takes place. That's the first half of the chapter through verse 12. And then 13 through the rest of the chapter recounts how Moses was able to receive advice and counsel from his father-in-law about how he could delegate some of the work that he was doing for the people. So we'll start with this this first half, the first 12 verses. You may remember weeks ago, months ago, I guess, really, back all the way in chapter 2, I believe it was, that when Moses had to flee Egypt, he goes into the wilderness and he encounters some sisters at a well. And one of those ends up becoming his wife. She was her name was Zipporah. And the father-in-law was Jethro. Before, we met Zipporah before, and we know that Moses had a couple of sons with Zipporah. Now, what we don't realize was that somewhere along the way, and we don't know where, but somewhere along the way, Moses initially headed back into Egypt. Until now, he sent his family back home to live with Jethro. So, you know, if you were just to read, and maybe you were assuming this as you went along, you know, if you were just to kind of read the story up to this point, you would assume that throughout all the stuff that went down in Egypt and leaving Egypt and everything else that's happened, that Moses' family was there with him. Well, they weren't. We weren't told that they left or when they left, but now we're told that they came back, because the chapter starts out this way. It says, Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel's people and how the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. So Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Moses' wife Zipporah after he had sent her away, one of whom was named Gershom, for he said, I have been a sojourner in a foreign land, and the other named Eleazar, for he said, the God of my father was my help and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. Brings Zipporah and these two sons to meet Moses in the wilderness. So you may remember there was that strange episode we encountered where God met Moses on the way and God tried to kill Moses and Zipporah circumcised her son. Remember that kind of strange episode from back in...
Puts the foreskin on the feet.
The foreskin on the feet. Yeah, we talked about all that. Some speculate, and I think with good reason, that after that happened, that Moses sent Zipporah and the sons back to stay with their father until he had completed his mission. Maybe it was later on. We don't know.
I mean, it makes sense if you're like heading into Egypt and you're going to go do this thing. I mean, I got a daughter. I'm probably not bringing her with me for that.
Yeah.
Especially, I mean, no matter how much I believe God, I'm still probably thinking like, yeah, it's probably a decent chance I'm going to die.
Yeah. I mean, it made practical sense. Of all the things that Moses had going on, he was completely consumed in the work that God sent him to do. He was, his life was in danger. And if his life was in danger, then the life of his family would also have been in danger. So maybe Moses thought, you know, it's just best to stay with Jethro until this whole ordeal is over.
Yeah, Chad, if you like send me and you're like, hey, I want you to go negotiate some terms with Vladimir Putin, like, which is not the same as Pharaoh, but just picking a name, I'm probably not going to be like, cool, can I take my 8-year-old with me?
Yeah, let's make a family vacation out of it.
No, probably not doing that. Probably going to go do that alone.
Evidently wisdom prevailed with Moses, and he decided he would send wife and children back home. They're reunited now. To summarize those first few verses, Jethro brings them back. So he shows up at the camp. And he sends word to Moses and says, I'm here. I'm bringing your wife and your two sons. So Moses goes out to meet them. And we have this, reunion. He bows down, kisses him, as they do in that culture. Ask about each other's welfare. And then then the guys go into the tent. And they have this conversation that takes place between Moses and Jethro. And this is where I think it gets very fascinating, because Jethro is a is not an Israelite. I mean, we knew that from the beginning. He's part of the Midianite clan. He's a priest. Now, one thing we don't know, because we're not told enough, exactly what Jethro believes about God. I mean, did he worship the same God as Moses? What did he think of the name Yahweh? Was he familiar with the name Yahweh? There's just a whole lot that we don't know. But most likely, Jethro was a non, well, you know, it was a non-Israelite, was a priest of whatever God the Midianites worship, whatever they call their God. So they have this conversation that takes place, and that's what I think is interesting here, is because this is Moses telling another family member, his father-in-law in this case, about the greatness of Yahweh, everything that Yahweh has done for the Israelites. Jethro confesses faith and says that this, in fact, is the true God. So here's the way the conversation goes. So Moses sits down in the tent with Jethro, and he tells him everything that God had done to the Egyptians for the sake of Israel. He tells them about all the hardships they had on the journey and how God delivered them from all of them. And it says in verse 9, Jethro rejoiced over all the goodness which Yahweh had done to Israel in delivering them from the hand of the Egyptians. And then we have this great confession. It says, Jethro says, so this priest says, blessed be Yahweh, not just God, but blessed be Yahweh, who delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the hand of Pharaoh, and who delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Verse 11. Now I know that Yahweh is greater than all the gods. Indeed, it was proven when they dealt proudly against the people. Now, I think that's pretty cool that here's a priest, a non-Israelite priest, who knows what his theology had been, out of hearing the gospel, more or less. This is the good news of God's redemption of his people from slavery. As a result of hearing this good news of God's deliverance, that in fact, Yahweh is the true God, that he is greater than all the other gods. And it was proven in God's deliverance of his people from slavery and from the hand of Pharaoh. So as a result of all this, Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, kind of wraps up their conversation by taking a burnt offering and sacrifices for God. And Aaron comes with all the elders of Israel, and they eat a meal with Moses' father-in-law before God. So that kind of wraps up the whole conversation. Moses relays everything to Jethro that's taken place. Jethro confesses faith in the true God, and they have a sacrifice and then a meal based upon those sacrifices afterward, as a way of celebrating their unity, as a way of celebrating everything that God had done for the Israelites, and probably also as a way of kind of sealing this bond between the Midianite people and the Israelites. So that's the first half of the chapter.
Yeah, man, you gotta be cool with the conversion of the in-laws.
Yeah.
Makes life easier.
Makes life a whole lot easier at family reunions, doesn't it?
Makes life easier if you're worshiping the same God. Yeah. Especially if your father-in-law is like a priest in another religion. I mean, that's like if your dad was like, your father-in-law is like a, you know, if you married some Hindu girl and your father-in-law happened to be
leader of the Hindus.
It makes things a lot easier if he ends up being like, you know what? I'm coming over.
I'm converting.
Yeah. All right, good. Good.
Well, yeah, this is one of many examples in the Old Testament where something like this happens. I think sometimes we get the impression that the Old Testament is all about Israel and Israel only, and not really concerned with anybody outside of Israel. This is like I said, one of many examples where that's proven to be false. God always had a greater vision than simply only the Israelites believing You know, like they were quarantined off from the rest of the world. In fact, we're going to later on when we get to Joshua, we have the great story of what happens inside the city of Jericho and Rahab. And she says something actually very similar to what Jethro does. She's already heard it before the spies get there. She's heard about everything that God has done for the Israelites. And she believes, and she rescues the spies. And she, even though a non-Israelite, is converted and joins with the Israelites. And then, of course, we have the whole story of Jonah, where, of course, God is concerned about the whole city of Nineveh, full of not only non-Israelites, but bloodthirsty terrorists. So God is always looking outside of the people of Israel, always eager to bring more people into his body of believers. He does that in various ways with various people.
Yeah, I mean, this is why. I mean, Paul makes this argument pretty clear in Romans 4, where he's basically saying, like, hey, God has always been the God of those of the circumcised and the uncircumcised. In fact, God has always been about making people children of Abraham through the shared faith of Abraham more than the shared circumcision of Abraham. I mean, this is exactly what he says in Romans 4. Like, yeah, like, circumcision is great, but ultimately, like, children of Abraham are those the circumcised or uncircumcised that share the same faith and the same promises and word of God that Abraham shared.
Yeah. Yeah, Abraham, we hear this already in Genesis 12, was a blessing to the nations.
Right.
You know, not just the nation of Israel, but he was the means that God was going to give blessings to all the nations. And so God always had a universal vision for his body of believers. God wasn't sort of, you know, kind of a ghetto God back in the Old Testament, only concerned about just this one little section of humanity. He always had a universal vision for the inclusion of many peoples. And it has happened probably more than we realize. I was talking to my wife about this the other day. You got this great story in the book of Acts about this eunuch from Ethiopia who has traveled to Jerusalem and who's going along in his chariot reading a scroll of the prophet Isaiah. Now just let that sink in for a minute. I mean, this guy is from Africa. Somehow he's got a copy of Isaiah. And he traveled all the way from Ethiopia to Israel, you know, bouncing along in his chariot, reading the prophet Isaiah. But I mean, it's pretty fascinating to me that somehow the faith of Israel got down into Ethiopia so that this guy believed to, you know, to such an extent that he traveled all the way to Israel and had a copy of Isaiah with him. And this is just an isolated example. Let's not how many other examples are like this, to where the faith of Israel was spreading throughout the world. We just don't have all those stories like we do here of Jethro.
Hey, this is all the result of missionary dating. I'm sure that's that is the case.
Probably started at a well. Yeah,
missionary dating. You go find some girl of a foreign religion. I'm sure that's how the Ethiopian eunuch got it. You know, someone dated someone they weren't supposed to, and there you go.
That's probably how it all started.
Yeah, that's not me endorsing missionary day. That's a joke. You know, try to find a good Christian girl or boy and enroll that way. But hey, sometimes you know, someone mixes it up with someone they're not supposed to, and God works it out anyway.
Look what happens.
There you go. All right, man, that's it. We're out of time. Guys, if you're listening to this right when it comes out, you still have time. You still have time to come hang out with us in Detroit for the city event that we're doing there. It is May the 6th. That is the Saturday forthcoming from the release of this podcast. So if you're in the Michigan area, you know what? You just show up at the door if you want, man. Just show up and come hang out with us. A bunch of us are going to be there. I'll be there. We're going to be talking about the I Am statements of Jesus. It's going to be great. So, you can go over to ChristHoldFast.org, go to the events page and get all the details of who's going to be there and what the times are and all that kind of stuff. But we'd love to see you there. Chad, dude, thanks. We'll see you next week.
Thank you, Dan. See you then.